Hi, friend. You're listening to a London Lyceum exclusive episode that is typically only available to subscribers. If you want to have access to all of our exclusive content, including Kiffin's Keep, Generally Particular, Typology by Immersion, The Hanover House, and all of our live stream content, consider joining for just $5 a month. Not only will you be getting access to all of this content and more, but you'll also be supporting and investing in an institution serious about thinking. So why not go ahead and click the link in the description now and enjoy all of the exclusive content directly to your mobile device or wherever you listen. As always, we're thinking about new ways to get you thinking, and we appreciate your support. Thanks for listening.
Well, all right, everyone. My name is Garrett Walden, and I'm happy to welcome you all to this edition episode of the Hanover House, a great conversation that we have with some friends of the London Lyceum. And so we're really grateful to have this dialogue. If you're unfamiliar with the London Lyceum more broadly, we are the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, as you often hear. And we get threats regularly from people to start their own confessional Baptist and analytic podcast, just so we can't say that anymore. But for now, I think we can still say that. And so, yeah, we have certain things that we try to think about and talk about together. We talk about analytic theology and talked about Baptist history and theology, and specifically thinking about Baptist history and theology from a confessional perspective. Many of us, at least, love the Second London Baptist Confession, and so that's always a fun point of unity and conversation. But we also have some particular theological virtues we like to emphasize in our discussions, and those revolve around charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. And so we like to try to emphasize not just the content, but a certain way of having the conversation and the dialogue. It's important that we can strive toward like-mindedness, but we really want to also value a kind of like-heartedness where we not just are striving toward the same truth, but trying to do it in the same kind of way, in a way that we think builds up the church. So the Hanover House in particular is just a dialogue among friends of the London Lyceum. Sometimes it's a bunch of people. Sometimes it's just a few people. It's just us getting together to talk about whatever's on our minds. It's usually kind of informal, and sometimes we have, you know, a plan and a bit of structure. Other times it's more free-flowing, and just it's more whatever is we don't want to look at, like, I don't know, hot takes on the latest social media buzz, but, you know, is there anything that's relevant and important right now that would be worthwhile to talk about and discuss together? And so I'm joined with, I'm joined by Jordan Stefaniak, of course. He is taking care of a baby right now, so that's why I'm doing the introduction here. And then also I'm joined by Caleb Hawkins, one of our editors for the London Lyceum. And so really grateful for these brothers. I know we have some other friends who are going to jump on at some point down the road, so there may be some more voices that you'll hear. But maybe just to get started, I think, Caleb, I might pass it off to you. You had a good question for discussion, so maybe you can just kind of introduce that, and we can talk about it for a bit.
Yeah, sure. We were just shooting the breeze here before getting started, thinking about, you know, we're at the London Lyceum trying to start a press and be impactful in a variety of areas, but one of them being Baptist history and a place for Baptists to have a theological voice. And that's exciting, but I think when I look at Baptist history and Baptist studies and people associated with the field of Baptist studies, the big names, the guys who have carried the torch, so to speak, in terms of publishing and publishing opportunities and kind of havens of research, a lot of them that come to mind, and maybe, Garrett, you can I'm missing names, a lot of them that come to mind are guys who are older, guys who are kind of in the later stages of their career, which is usually some of the most fruitful parts of a career, right? So guys like Michael Haken or Tom Nettles. And I think of a guy like Michael Haken, who has done so much for the field, but I'm always wondering what's going to happen to the field in terms of its the mantle being taken up once they're gone, guys like Haken and Nettles and others. So I thought it'd be interesting to just ask the question, thinking about the legacy of someone like Michael Haken and Tom Nettles, but also thinking about what does it look like as they kind of have to hand the torch off in some ways in years to come.
I think that's a great question, Caleb. Just another name to include in that list of kind of senior scholars would certainly be someone like Timothy George. And I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting, but I'm thinking in particular about Baptist historians. There are other kind of senior scholars in systematic theology and biblical studies. But those men in particular are such an encouragement and blessing when you just think about some of the things that they have been a part of. You know, really starting back, I suppose they were kind of coming into their professional careers in the 70s, and maybe in the 80s too. But that's, you know, in Baptist life in America at least, there's a lot of theological liberalism, and the seminaries are really being impacted by that. And so much of someone like Dr. Nettles' influence was in what's been called the battle for the Bible. And so they really have done the hard work of demonstrating from Baptist history a Baptist bibliology. And what an amazing gift that is. And then also thinking about Dr. Nettles in particular, his involvement with Founders Ministries throughout the 90s and 2000s. Yeah. Hey, I know he still contributes there too, but kind of the revitalization of the doctrines of grace in Southern Baptist life. And of course, Dr. Haken has been a part of that too, just in terms of kind of retrieving the Calvinistic Baptist heritage from the English Baptists in particular. But then, I mean, Timothy George has done so much about in the area of Reformation theology as a Baptist historian. And so really, when I think about my own place as a Baptist history student, so much of what I'm doing is only because of what they've already done. I'm not having to argue about theological liberalism and, you know, inerrancy and even the doctrines of grace. Those things are, I think, at least in my circle, you know, not always hotly contested. And it's really because they did the tough sledding decades ago. So in a big way, we're kind of reaping where we did not sow. And it does make you wonder, you know, what will be the key theological and historical issues that our generation of Baptist theologians and historians will have to wrestle with. There were so many faithful men during that period with those issues. I would like to think we're not going to have to relitigate all of those same issues, but maybe can move on to different issues. But I mean, who knows?
Yeah. So here's a possible hot take on this topic. Another name who I think deserves to be in some of these discussions is James Renahan, right? So he's done a ton of amazing work and has been an institution builder, and you know, just I think he's up there as well. But so just from my personal experience, I went to Reformed Theological Seminary for my MDiv, and a lot of my interaction with Reformed Baptist literature was through guys like James Renahan and Sam Renahan, to try to interact in the Reformed world with Baptist thought in a Presbyterian world that I was in. And so most of my Reformed Baptist reading was from kind of, you know, that school of Renahan brother, I mean, father, son, and Barcelos and all of those guys who were all just lifelines for me. But think about this with me. Maybe I'm just not seeing this. I never read those men or heard those men ever say anything about Andrew Fuller and his generation. Like, I never hear them say, like, I feel like I was so unaware of that generation of particular Baptist, because that school of kind of Baptist history and Baptist historical theology, to me, just never talks about them. It wasn't really until I discovered Haken and got more involved with Haken that I realized, oh man, there's some amazing 18th century particular Baptists I just felt like I knew nothing about, because all my reading had been from that particular crowd of folks.
Yeah, I think you're not necessarily wrong. And in my reading of Jim Renahan, who, yeah, I should have included him. He's made a big impact on my life and through his books and lectures and things like that. He's definitely deserves to be included on that list of senior scholars. But, you know, he has done some work on Andrew Fuller and has published in that area. But I think for so many of, I don't know, maybe that wing of Calvinistic Baptist scholarship, they focus so much on the 17th century. That's just maybe 18th century isn't as much their area of focus. So when you think about Dr. Renahan's book, Edification and Beauty, on ecclesiology, it really doesn't try to survey Baptist ecclesiologies deep into the 18th century. And then, yeah, Sam Renahan's stuff is mostly, 17th century stuff. Plus, I mean, they're also very deep into other Puritan era stuff, like John Owen-related things. So I think some of it has to do with just research interest. And everyone's going to have limitations. So, for instance, I was talking to Jake Stone the other day, and my American Baptist history knowledge is not that great. The more I started to think about it, I was like, you know, I'm pretty much good on Baptist history in England from, like, up to, I don't know, 1815 when Fuller died. And that's pretty much it. Like, my global Baptist history knowledge isn't that great. So I realized a big gap in my own knowledge. I need to diversify a little bit. That's one of the reasons I really like Dr. Haken so much.
It all goes downhill after
and respect him is because
it goes downhill after 1815.
Yeah.
So why do you need to know?
The 19th century was a disaster. Yeah. But one of the things I love about Dr. Haken is, you know, he isn't just an 18th century Baptist guy. He's also a 4th century person. Yeah. I mean, that was his doctoral study, was in the 4th century. So I think it really is interesting to think about diversity of scholarly focus. And speaking of that, Jordan, you're one of those people, like, you have such a broad range of interest. Maybe you could, I don't want to take us away from this discussion too quickly, but, like, how do you have such a broad range of, like, scholarly competence? Not just you've got an opinion about it, but, like, I mean, publishing in those areas.
Well, I have the bad habit of being interested in a lot of things. And I would say, besides that, like, if you want to actually, you know, realistically, I'm not an expert in all that, and I'm fine admitting that. What I do have that is helpful for me is I have relationships and friendships with people who are experts, so that I can go ask them, and then I have a trusted relationship to say, if they're telling me this, I'm confident that that's where I need to spend my time researching and reading and writing and thinking on. And so I can circumvent some of the laborious process of, like, trial and error and reading a bunch of bad sources to find the good sources to develop your stuff. So I can, like, skip a lot of the stuff that takes time to develop some of those skills, and where I can quickly gain competency in an area. I'm not an expert, but I'm competent enough in it to speak in a way that is coherent and can converse with some of the literature. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, the right people, and you ask them and they give you advice.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's one of the things I really like about working with the London Lyceum is I really have like a pretty narrow sliver of knowledge, but you know, reading some of the stuff that comes across our desk for the London Lyceum, for essays online, book reviews, stuff for the journal, stuff for Hanover Press, like it's a real education for me to, you know, reading an essay on, I don't know, moral theory. It's like I never had any classes on that or even books on that in seminary or college, and so that sort of regular exposure has been helpful to me.
I mean, you need people who are generalists in some respect. You need, like, there's value in that. There's a danger in that, and most people can't do it very well. And if you you have to have somebody who's willing to recognize that they're not an expert and say that up front, because you can't be an expert in everything. But you do need people who like are able to like be conversant with a lot of stuff to help a lot of those different things. Hunter, did you shave your beard?
Yeah, I don't want
to
talk about it.
I just saw my wife just sent me a video, or maybe it was me who sent it to her, where this guy shaved his beard for the first time in 10 years and his kids were crying at the sight of him because they didn't recognize him.
Look, I messed up shaving. The trimmer, the guards didn't do right. Look, I've been hearing it all week. So this is it. So.
Well, I'm sorry to bring it up.
This is like a time machine going back to college, Hunter.
Yeah, you can see my double chin a little bit clearer now that
I knew some Baptist churches in some rural areas where I'm at that would not let you preach unless you were clean shaved. That was a big deal, a huge deal.
Was it Jake's church?
Speaking of clean shaved.
I think it was IFB. I think it was some,
oh my goodness.
Garrett stumbled upon that great preaching gaffe video of mine, and in that video I am basically bald because I experienced a poor haircut experience. I was when I was in college, I was dumb, and I'd have my friends like help cut my hair, and my friend, like, he took no guard. I was like, I just need help like trimming around my neck for me, and he took it and he just like went straight up with no guard, and I was like,
oh boy.
So then I was bald for like 3 weeks.
Boy,
man. Well, Hunter, we're glad that you're here. We were just talking about the senior scholars of Baptist history kind of maybe in the more advanced stage of their career. And what's coming next?
You missed David Bevington.
Who's
going
to pick up the
Peter
mantle?
Peter Morden.
Yeah, I think Jordan's.
Yeah, those names are
on
a big
British
part of
side
it.
That are really important.
I mean, I got Garrett Walden, Jake Stone, Caleb. You doing Baptist history?
Yeah,
Jordan.
Yeah.
The Hanover Press.
Well, you also Matt Bingham, I think, is a nice, like, you know, he's not old, but he's not like super young. He's established himself enough. I think of him as one of the up and coming, like, guys who's going to replace the legacy Baptist historians. Now, I know there's a lot of people like Garrett and Jake who take issue with some of the terminology that's used. I tend to think Matt's right, but even so, I think everybody recognizes that Matt is a true Baptist historian. Like, he's doing actual historical work and doing it in a creative and useful way.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who else.
Well, you know, someone who's
might be,
on the younger
someone
side,
who's kind
are, we,
of mediating.
Have we, are we moving on to the younger side?
Well, someone who's kind of mediating the kind of generational gap we're talking about is someone like Thomas Kidd. I mean, he's advanced in his career, but he's not like on the home stretch. And so,
is he a Baptist historian?
He's a great Baptist
more
historian.
Like American historian.
Oh, totally.
He's a Baptist.
Well, he's
and
a
historian.
He's a Baptist.
I don't
historian.
Know that he's writing a lot of.
And he's written a book on Baptist history in America. And so,
has
yeah,
he really?
He's a great
has
Baptist
read that
historian.
Book other than
with Barry Hankins.
Yeah. Yeah. What, Thomas Kidd is a top tier scholar.
Oh, absolutely. I think everyone would agree with that. But in terms of, like, I don't think you, if you asked 100 people in our circles, if you think of Thomas Kidd as a Baptist historian in terms of that's his field, I don't think anyone would say that.
We got Jeff Chang. Maybe he's just a historian who's a Baptist.
Yeah. Jeff Spurgeon guys, you know, Alex DePrima being a Spurgeon guy. I feel like there's a lot of guys who like have like knit their own niche inside Baptist history, but aren't like doing like Baptist, capital B Baptist history.
On the American side, Eric Smith has written a couple.
Oh, that's
books.
True. Eric is doing fabulous
job. They're legit.
I
mean, he's writing Oxford University Press books.
Like he goes to sleep and writes a book. I don't get it.
Yeah, he's amazingly productive. Another person who maybe would be in that, you know, big V, capital B, Baptist history is someone like Nathan Finn. So I think there are people who are, you know, aren't newbies like I am, but who have been around a little while that are coming up. One of the things that I'm interested in, like I mentioned earlier, is, you know, that older generation of Baptist historians were really defending the doctrines of grace in kind of the Calvinism controversy. They're defending the doctrine of the inspiration of Scripture and the battle for the Bible. And I'm interested in kind of what particular aspects our generation will be tasked to really dig our heels on, mainly because, you know, you'd hate for all of your scholarly work to be reactionary based on some sort of crisis in a denomination or something like that. But I think that's often how it goes, is your topic of focus gets handed to you by your historical situation, not always by what you think merits the most attention.
The inescapability of the present when we're trying to talk about the past. You can't escape it, almost.
That sounds very modernistic, Hunter.
More postmodernistic.
Whatever. Yeah, I'm just trying to get under your skin.
Oh, that's all right. I think it'll be. What I'm interested in is getting more narratives that aren't framed around the Anabaptist question. And I'm seeing how
that's another one. Paige Patterson, tremendous Baptist historian.
I don't know about that.
Where's my S-step book?
Bill S-step. Well, okay. What would we say about Malcolm Yarnell?
He's not a Baptist historian.
Yeah, he'd be more Baptist theologian.
Yeah, that's true. He's more of a Baptist theologian.
I don't have much to say about Malcolm Yarnell.
Madison Grace is the guy who's at Southwestern, who's the historian.
I don't know much who that is.
I don't know much about him.
I had him for my Baptist Heritage class there. Now, it was a three-day intensive, so.
I'll tell you, one of my favorite classes at Southern was a seminar with Matthew Hall. It was a great history class on American evangelicalism. You know, he hasn't really focused, I don't think, as much on Baptists specifically, but he's a great historian who's a Baptist. So I think there are people, and I think it's going to happen. So let me just tell you, one of my concerns is that there's a real trend and fad of theological retrieval that doesn't always excite me. Especially
when in the flames.
this really gets me. Just because, I mean, I'm doing retrieval. I'm a supporter of the retrieval kind of ressourcement project. So I'm a big fan of that. I think there's a good way to do it and there's a bad way to do it. And sometimes I worry that our reading of the past isn't really true to their historical context. And that's why I think someone like Matt Bingham is so good, because he's such a careful historian. And someone like Jim Renahan in particular is so good because he's a really careful historian and is very careful to speak with historical credibility, rather than just like, here's theology that I believe in and here's someone else that used similar words from the past. And so I really am kind of anxious to see how our generation of historians will temper their historical work and stay in the lane of the historian rather than venturing into other theological or dogmatic claims, or at least signal when you're doing that.
Explain to me what you mean by that, Garrett, because I don't understand how you separate historian and theologian.
Well, so here, I'll give my two cents on what I think and try to interpret for Garrett, because I think what seems to be going on is, like, first of all, we've got to define what we mean by retrieval. By retrieval, do we mean just like I'm going to use like some of the resources from the past in a constructive contemporary way and have no care for the historical setting and things like that. So I've done some things along those lines. I wrote an essay on Herman Bavinck's sort of like philosophy of mind, but I was pretty clear in that essay saying, like, I'm not trying to reconstruct Bavinck's actual views in all their own like complexity and historical locatedness and stuff. I don't really care. I'm more of just like, I think there's some resources here for some contemporary debates that could be used. And so I think this is useful. I think that's an aspect of retrieval. I think that's fine. You have to be self-consciously describing what you're doing there. I'm not doing a historical task there. I'm doing just a constructive contemporary task in that sense. The problem comes when retrieval is casted as this like historical mode of historical theology, where you abstract these ideas from their context, and then you're not doing the proper historical steps. So you're basically trying to recast individuals into your own theological, you know, like your own theological team, your own theological hero, whoever it is. You're recasting these historical figures and ignoring portions of them and not saying that in order to present them as, like, you know, purveyors of your current vision. So let's say theological interpretation of scripture, you could say, well, John Gill is a theological interpretation of scripture. Like, he's an advocate of TIS. And I'm going to show you all the reasons that he's an advocate of the contemporary version of TIS. But what you could not do is you ignore a bunch of his commentaries, or you ignore a bunch of his different comments in different books, and you ignore some of the historical locatedness of his works to the point where you're really presenting a version of Gill that's not Gill. It's a highly curated, selective portion of Gill that is missing all the warts that would distort that picture. I think that's part of what Garrett's issue is there's a distortion that goes on. And sometimes it seems to be consciously they're trying to distort the picture, and other times it's just they don't know what they're doing, and so they're like unconsciously doing it. But that causes difficulty down the lines, because if you are not being honest about the sort of like selective historical work you're doing, people will find out eventually, and then they won't trust your work, and then they'll go down these stupid YouTube, you know, whatevers, and become Roman Catholics, because Roman Papists, I should say. I've been consciously trying not to give them the word Catholic. It's mine. And so these papists, they'll become papists because they get in these YouTube videos that are like, oh yeah, the Protestants, they don't read history. As you see, they just, you know, they whitewash all their stuff. Is that somewhat what you're trying to say, Garrett?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Yeah, I'm really eager to see the past speak wisdom into our issues of the present. I just really want to make sure we allow the past to have its distinctive voice. One of Dr. Haken's favorite quotes is from a book that I can't remember, but I remember it from Haken. He says, you know, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. And I think part of it. Fia says that too. But I heard it from Haken.
So, Fia 2020 or 2022 or 2024 version.
This was pre-Trump Fia.
I got it right here. I'll find it real quick.
That was pre-Trump Fia. The point that I'm making, though, is I think part of the historian's task is to abide in that recognition that they do things differently there, and not try to bring them directly into the present as if there was no difference of time and space. And so just here's an example. The I'm working on a paper right now on John Gill and the free offer of the gospel. And I'll be honest with you, it's blowing my mind some of the things that I'm finding in Gill. Some of it's really frustrating to me because I think I don't really like some of the things I find in Gill on this particular issue. But the more I read it, the more I feel like I really understand what he's trying to say. And I see why he has the problems that he has with the idea of the free offer. And so, for instance, I think he is writing and doing ministry in the shadow of Richard Baxter's soteriology, which was a disaster. And so I've been told
Baxter's great.
You've been lied to. and those are not your friends. They view these 18th century Baptists at least viewed Baxterianism as they would put it on the list of like heresies. And so it was a big, big deal. And so part of the issue of the free offer was that it basically implied that there are conditions to be met in the new covenant on the part of the believer receiving the offer. And so is the new covenant, does it have conditions, or is it a pure gift and promise? And so you'll read Gill say the new covenant, the covenant of grace, has no conditions. It is pure promise and good news. And so the idea of an offer necessitates conditions to be fulfilled, which is to blend law and gospel. So this is why he denies duty faith, too. And so, like, for him, you know, if you just say, like, Gill denied the free offer and he denied duty faith, okay, that's technically true, but I just don't think we've done right by Gill to not explore why and understand what exactly motivated him to say that. And so for me, that's what I don't want to just make a theological verdict that Gill was wrong on this. I want to do the work of a historian to understand why he was saying this, and then to give Gill the space historically to say that and to make his argument. And in some ways, I think he's right. But we don't really live in the shadow of Richard Baxter the way that he did. And so I don't know that we could, it's not a one-to-one application now anymore. So anyway, I'm kind of rattling on here, but I just think we really need to do good history. And maybe, Hunter, you would just say some of my problems of historians speaking theologically is what you would just call bad history.
But maybe, yeah, not. I mean, I guess, like, I'm trying to think of it in terms of the retrieval movement. Like, I see that when people don't know theology and they see words and language that mean completely opposite things, or they're not respecting the context. So, I mean, I'm patristic. So, you know, we got, you know, you have to understand, you know, Valentinianism and Gnosticism in the anti-Nicene context to understand how these early fathers confessed and worshiped the Trinity. You know, they weren't Nicene in their language. I think they are consistent with Nicene and not consistent with Arianism. But when you read them in light of the fourth century creeds, then you're missing the point. You're not able to see how they're confessing the Trinity in their own terms. I'm thinking in those terms. But I'm trying to think of retrieval, though, of like, not to get it away from like recent works. I mean, does that mean like Banner of Trust is fundamentally flawed in their mission? I mean, they're just bringing these texts out of context to the people, like, or Gill in his book, The Cause and Vindication of Truth, and how he goes through all the fathers and says they're all supporting Calvinism. Like, are they just Joseph Ivanhoe and his histories? Are they all just fundamentally flawed and their understanding of the past is just completely off?
So, Hunter, maybe a question for all of us on this is, retrieval obviously is a hot word, but at least for me, I feel like there's a lot of people trying to practice retrieval, but there's not been a lot of clarification on what do we mean by the word, and methodology of retrieval is almost like I can think of a thousand books right now that say they're doing retrieval. I can think of two recent books, and someone can help me with more, that are specifically on methodology. One, a book from T&T Clark. It was a series of essays edited by Darren Serensky on theologies of retrieval, which tries to do something on methodology from different standpoints. And then Gavin Ortland's kind of more popular level, which is really more an inspiration for retrieval. Do we think the problem is we don't have no clue what we mean by the word retrieval? I think there needs to be a lot of work done on methodology.
So here's what John Webster calls it. He says, retrieval is a mode of theology, an attitude of mind and a way of approaching theological tasks, which present with greater or lesser prominence in a range of different thinkers, not all of them self-consciously conservative or orthodox. And he continues to go on, but it seems that, you know, he's describing it more of as a mode and sort of like an attention to particular resources.
It's interesting that, you know, he says it's a mode of theology. It's not a mode of historiography. And I think that's kind of the place where I'm wrestling with the retrieval movement is sometimes I think it portrays itself as this is a work of church history, whereas it's actually this is a work of systematic or dogmatic theology that's trying to be sensitive to history. And so I think those are two different kinds of things. And so I think for me, Dr. Haken, if you talk to him, if you ask him, what exactly is your vocation? He'll say, I'm a church historian. He does not say, I am a historically informed theologian. Of course, you know, R.C. Sproul's book title, Everyone's a Theologian. We all are theologizing. And Dr. Haken, when you read his works of history, he is very theologically adept. He sometimes will make, you know, his perspective, his own opinion known. He certainly does in his lectures and teaching. But for me, it makes sense to me to have a mode of writing that is primarily historical and then a different kind of mode of writing that's primarily theological. And I think as a researcher and as a scholar, we ought to let our audience know what exactly we're doing. Here's an example. I read an essay recently that I think is a fine essay, but I read it thinking that I was reading a church history essay. And I thought for that reason, the essay maybe wasn't very strong. And when I mentioned that in my feedback on it, the person corrected me and says, I'm writing this more as like a constructive theological essay. And I'm just kind of using this history as like a way to like talk about my ideas. I'm like, okay, well, that's completely different then. I think maybe this is fine. And so you just need
it's
to say
dangerous, though.
You need to say that.
So this is how I define. I looked up my book manuscript that I haven't looked at in 4 months, and I define retrieval this way. Theological retrieval is a project of careful historical research that reappropriates the insights gleaned for a modern context. So that scratches the itch for Garrett and is different than how Webster would just go. It's kind of like a mode, whereas this involves actual historical work if you want to do retrieval right.
Yeah, Hunter, you look like you got something on your mind.
I just think me or Caleb?
Hunter.
What's hard for me is it like, really what we're talking about though is how they're reading the scriptures. When we're doing church history, typically we're getting at, you know, what judgments are they making based on their interpretation of the scriptures, which are timeless. So that's the hard thing for me. I mean, so it's like, and there's an element which, you know, to take the Nicene Trinitarianism stuff, like, I think there's a methodology that makes use of the Nicene Creed that's current now that may not have been the case, let's say, in Gill's day. Is Gill Nicene in that sense? Like, no, he's probably not making use of the Nicene Creed like I would today or something like that, highlighting it. But he's definitely consistent with Nicene Trinitarianism. He uses double procession. He uses all the, you know, the language and those kind of things, eternal generation, that kind of stuff. And so it's kind of like, you know, there's an element of, I think there's two tensions. I think there's two sensibilities of those who want to preserve the distinctiveness of the individual thought and the nuances of how they're different and the unique contributions that they make and those kind of things. And there's a sensibility to show the unity of the Catholic faith, you know, that this, you know, we still believe the same thing that, you know, the faith once and all for all delivered to the saints. And I think both sensibilities are important, and I think sometimes they get mad at each other. My sensibility is to show unity in the, you know, we, you know, because I think that's important, you know. And because I think, you know, I think, Garrett, one of the things that I've heard you say recently, or type, I've read you type recently, is that the Baptist movement is a retrieval movement within a retrieval movement. And so my question then would be, is it like, did the churches in 100 AD look like the Baptist churches in England in 1700s? Is that what you're meaning? Or, you know, you look at First Clement and, you know, the epistles of Ignatius and saying like this, see, this is what we're Baptists are doing is what they were doing. Like they were like card carrying Baptists, like the English Baptists were. That's where I'm trying to wrestle with like all of these different critiques and really want to know more positively, like constructively, how we do retrieval well in various modes. Because I'm thinking more as a pastor. I mean, that's my primary role. So that's kind of like where I'm thinking is kind of like a great works type thing, like learning from these figures in a way that helps me shepherd people today better. So I'm very much in search of a usable past.
So, I mean, yeah, I think that's right. So like retrieval, I think there's two aspects to it. Like there's an aspect of like, it's a resource that I am to receive and appropriately understand, but it's also a resource that I'm to like build and like grow based, like stand up on their shoulders. So it's not just a like excavation project. It's also like a construction project based upon the resources that I have. So I think it's like a both and. So to me, if you want to do retrieval right, you have to do both. And why, which makes it very difficult. Yes. If you want to do, you know, retrieval in a proper mode.
You want to know someone who did this really well is Matthew Lapine in his book, Logic of the Body. That
I disagree with some of his stuff.
I'm sure you do, and I want to hear about that. But as in terms,
I like him, and I think the book is pretty well done. I've just got some issues.
And yeah, I'm that doesn't surprise me at all. But in terms of method, I thought he did a really good job of doing historical work on Calvin, for instance. That was like, I think, good, like theologically sensitive history of Calvin, and then he. There was a pretty decisive turn in which he did his own constructive work. And for me, it made sense. His constructive work meant more to me because I saw where he was coming from historically. But he wasn't trying to say he wasn't trying to make Calvin like be the person that's saying exactly what he's saying. I thought he kept his history very tightly historical. And I really appreciated that. And so what I'm not trying to say is that we can be like scientific method, absolute, purely objective readers and writers of history. We're all coming with biases and presuppositions and all that sort of thing. We take ourselves with us everywhere we go, including when we're trying to write history. But I guess I'm eager to see how the methodology is going to shake out for our generation, because I think there's such a big emphasis and interest in retrieval. I just want to see it done well and with some methodological guards, so that, like Jordan mentioned, our claims are not laughed at in the generation that follows us. And that's what I worry is going to be the case.
I mean, I definitely get that. And that's
real,
the things that, you know,
a real bummer to end on there.
Well, I guess, I mean, the thing is I guess, like, I don't know. I mean, I there's a sense in which I want to say, yeah, like, since 381, like, the Orthodox have been Nicene Trinitarianism. You know, they've affirmed that. You know, like, John Gill was a Nicene Trinitarian in that sense, like, theologically, not saying historically. Those who confess Westminster, those who confess Second London, like, they're consistent with Nicene Trinitarianism. So if you don't affirm Nicene Trinitarianism, like, you're out of step with the historic position of the church, like, from 381 all the way through Second London Confession of Faith. Like, I don't see a problem saying those kind of things, or, you know, even like some of the things, Jordan, that you're talking about, like with the classical theism book. I guess some of the things, like, I understand, like, our critiques about retrieval and some of those in our camp, but most of the critiques I hear towards retrieval are from people who actually don't want those doctrines retrieved. Like, I've had one professor in my class specifically say he doesn't like retrieval because he doesn't think those things should be retrieved. Certain aspects of it. You know, he's a strict memorialist. He's anti-TIS. He's anti that kind of reading, any kind of theological interpretation of scripture, typology, those kind of things. And, you know, or they're
I bet
not
he's really fun at dinner parties.
Huh?
Sorry, it's just, I'm just making a joke. Just go on.
But, so that's what I'm trying to wrestle with is, like, I do see one of the hard things is there is a strong dissonance in just where the state of theology was over the last 100 years with what the church has historically confessed. And I think that adds a little bit of urgency to the retrieval movement that I just, like, I don't know.
Yeah. So
my sensibilities are still strongly
to comment
with those
on that.
For pursuing it, even if I disagree with how they're doing it sometimes.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, Gill is a Nicene Trinitarian. I think that that's true. I think he agreed with the theology of Nicaea. To make a claim like Gill is a Nicene Trinitarian, I think you need to demonstrate from Gill's writings his consistency with Nicaea, which you can do. But I think to say that Gill affirmed the Nicene Creed is a slightly different thing, and you would need to demonstrate from his writings. You need to basically have a paper trail to show historically that Gill affirmed the Nicene Creed, which you can also do because he does that. He'll even cast the Trinitarian debate of his day as kind of, there's the Athanasians versus the Arians is kind of the terminology that he'll use. And so, like, he's very aware of the Nicene issue and is taking the side of Nicaea very explicitly. And so for me, I'm comfortable with retrieving Gill's Trinitarianism and calling it retrieving Nicene Trinitarianism from the 18th century Baptists because there's a paper trail. To say something like, you know, is Gill a Dortian Calvinist? Is a important question. You know, does he agree with the Synod of Dort on matters of Calvinism? Well, you could read Cause of God and Truth and go tick a bunch of boxes. Well, it is helpful when he actually does recognize and comment on the Synod of Dort. He'll even put it in his footnotes at times. And so I think having that kind of that data in the record gives you a place to stand. Now, if you were to try to say, you know, Gill is in agreement with the Heidelberg Catechism. That's a slightly different question because I don't know of a place where Gill ever references the Heidelberg Catechism. I'm sure that he read it. I'm sure that he liked it. I can't imagine that Gill would have hated the Heidelberg Catechism. But to my knowledge,
Gill is cold. The Heidelberg Catechism is warm. Of course he wouldn't like it.
So for me to say, you know, is Gill on board with Heidelberg, I don't know that there's a paper trail where that data point is can be historically substantiated. I think you can make a theological claim and say theologically he aligns on XYZ issues, but historically, because there's not the data to back it up, I don't think a historian should make that claim. But anyway, that's kind of, I hate to dominate the conversation with this particular issue. We can talk about something different, but.
Oh, man, this is interesting. Now I want to, like, call the people who are doing bad versions of retrieval, like, retrieval activists. Because, you know, everybody gets mad about what Dumais and whoever else do an activist history. That's what it is. It's yeah. activist retrievalism. So that's I'm going to coin that and start activist using it. Retrieval.
That's a good tweet. That'd be a good tweet.
Yeah.
But maybe here's maybe one of the issues is not necessarily the idea or the aspiration or even the content, but I think the medium of itself of publishing right now doesn't promote careful, well thought, aged scholarship on some of this stuff. It promotes this is a really hot trend and something we can really capitalize in theological publishing. So there's a rush to do exciting things before kind of the buzz dies down. So for example, I think Crossway and the Center for Classical Theism are joining to do like a big series on retrieving Thomas Aquinas. Like something on Thomas and the sacraments, something on Thomas and soteriology, Thomas and doctrine of God, these sorts of things. That's kind of unbelievable to me, at least, that Crossway is going to take on a project of retrieving Thomas, and all of the authors are going to be men who did their PhDs on Reformation history, and who at Crossway is going to edit seriously Aquinas.
You can be a Thomas expert in 6 months. Trust me.
But you know, that's what I'm not bashing on them. But I'm just saying the medium itself promotes quick projects to hit the fix. And so I think the worry is that this is going to come out for evangelicals as an embarrassment of such a quick kind of rush to do retrieval, and then people outside of evangelicalism see that it was sloppy work.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons. You know, the whole publishing industry and all of it sort of like promotes and pushes, especially like in evangelicalism, pushes people to do things way too fast. Like you said, and then that just gives you half-baked material across the board. And that's not exclusive to like any camp or any person. That's just like you look at all these people, like how do you write 2 books a year? Like that's insane. Like if you're like writing like self-help books, I can understand it. Like look yourself in the mirror and tell yourself that you're great. Like, okay, I can understand how you can write 2 books a year. Writing actual like academic monographs, 2 books a year, that's impossible. That is actually impossible. Anybody who's doing that is not writing academic monographs. It's just that's not realistic.
Yeah. So Caleb, I think you make a great point. What's so interesting is I can't speak for Crossway, but what I think probably is happening is as long as the theology checks the boxes, the thing that gets short run is the historical methodology. And I think that's my concern with the retrieval fad and trend is I think the theology that's being retrieved is fine. At least a lot of the times it is. But the way that they got it is the part that bothers me. And the claims that they make about the history, I think, is not always the most careful. And so when you're looking at a book and it's, you know, it's heading for the press, I mean, as long as it's, you know, good theology, maybe they didn't take in all of Scotus's view on the will, or maybe they were completely reliant on secondary literature. That kind of issue is to me the kind of thing that betrays a historiographical compromise, even if theologically it's fine. The way that they got there, to describe it as a kind of historical retrieval, for me is a violation.
Yeah, I mean, anybody writing on Scotus, if they haven't done like graduate coursework on Scotus, should just cut the material. Like, there are certain individuals that are so stupid and complex and hard to understand that it's like it's just not worth it. So, for example, I took a PhD seminar on Aristotle a very long time ago. A lot of times when people talk about Aristotle, it's very clear immediately they've never read Aristotle. They've read other people talk about Aristotle. or they've heard other people talk about Aristotle. They've heard about the categories. They've heard about substance, and they've heard about these different things. They're not familiar with actual nuances and the progression of his thought and the conflicts between things like the categories and his metaphysics, because they've never actually read it. And that's a serious problem, like across theology in general. Theologians, by and large, have a very bad habit of relying on secondary literature to make these sort of judgments. And it would be better to just leave that on the cutting floor. Like, you're not going to get graded off because you didn't mention Aristotle or you didn't mention this other important figure. Like, either do the work to become knowledgeable or don't talk about them. That's my two cents. But we're at 55
before
minutes.
Before we break, Hunter.
Yeah, so.
Are we done? How long are we going?
Before we break.
I don't know. Go, Garrett.
I just wanted to ask before we conclude how your dissertation writing is going, Jordan. And I mean that as a sincere question, not a trap. I know you're trying to grind it out like this month, so.
I have not touched it in the last month. But that's in part due to a couple of factors, and that one of my co-supervisors, you know, took a role at the University of Oklahoma. And so that meant that I had to get a new co-supervisor who now has to get up to speed on my work before it gets sent to an internal and external examiner and all the yada, yada, yada. So I'm waiting on him to give me feedback based upon the material that he hasn't read yet. And then hopefully I'm given the green light to put it all together for them and to send off the final product. I'm probably not going to do much more writing on it. I'm just going to, like, put it in one document and then say, please pass this and don't make me do revisions.
Yeah, and then you're already talking about a second PhD.
See. I mean, I've got, like, six irons in the fire that I'm like, I could go one of these things. And so we'll see what happens. I'd like to do a second one, but it might be for a few more years. I don't know when the time is right.
You're a bold man.
So, can a materialist affirm Chalcedon, Jordan? Yes.
Oh, of course they can.
Of course they can.
Of course they can. If they
Cyril Alexandria, the famous materialist.
If they make certain, you know, adjustments, a reductive materialist cannot affirm Chalcedon. A non-reductive materialist can if they make certain sort of like caveats and claims and are okay with certain sorts of language and metaphysical principles. Yes, they can.
I'm just messing with you.
Jordan's got a book contract with Banner of Truth on this topic right here.
Yeah, right.
Hey, speaking of this, Garrett, I don't know if you've read Gribben's work on Owen. He absolutely rips Banner of Truth for this exact thing.
I don't remember that. What book is this?
The one where he, you know, presents Owen as this big fat loser who loses at everything he does.
Like the small one?
Not the small one, the big one.
Okay, I've only read the small Crossway one.
It's a fantastic book. And I saw a good interchange between a couple other fellow students from Southern, or one former student and one fellow student, and just talking about how good of a work it is and how, even if you disagree with some of his conclusions, it really advances the scholarship of John Owen. But he rips Banner of Truth for doing bad history and the name of retrieval.
Crawford Gribben's your man.
See, you got him. Really leans into like speech acts theory too. Some of the linguistics.
I like Crawford is a fun dude to talk to. He is hilarious.
But I mean, his whole thing is like if your view of Owen is death of death, then like your view of Owen is so skewed because you don't.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think everybody agrees with that.
And so, but he says basically the whole project of Banner of Truth leads to.
You can't fault a publisher for publishing portions of his work at certain periods of time and promoting it. Like, that's not their fault.
Well, I think it's the way that it gets the republishing of the volume. So it's also the guy who, like, the way that the volumes are given, not chronologically. You get what I'm saying? Like, he's saying you have to read them.
Yeah, well, that's just being a little nerdy, which is probably accurate and true, but I still wouldn't fault them for that.
I wonder what you think of the Crossway.
Sometimes they abridge those Owen volumes. Well, you have to. And you have to modernize it a little bit, help him out so that he can be understood. But so maybe some things got lost in the production that were important to keep in.
Yeah. And I do think, and I going back to the kind of the theologian and historian, like I do think it's important to be like sharp theologians in doing history. And it comes across, like it came across even in like we talking about, I mean, we had a conversation with Ryan was talking about, you know, virtue and stuff and, or the infusion of virtue and John Owen and how, you know, like it was brought up in one of the interviews and that was like, oh, he never even talk about this, you know, and it's just cause he just missed it. You know, like I think there's an, you have to be, it's like, as I'm talking about virtue and Justin Martyr, like I've had to really understand the field of virtue before I could understand historically what Justin was doing with virtue ethics. And I think it's like that with any kind of doctrine. Like if you don't really understand that doctrine well, and you're seeing it in these persons, you're missing, you're going to miss the intricacies. And that's where I think there needs to be, like, when you're doing histories of theological figures, like, I think you have to be really sharp theologically or you're not going to understand what they're saying.
So here's another problem with evangelicals, especially young men at seminaries, is that they get big heads and they want to pretend that they've read more than they've actually read. And so then they get too big for their britches. And they start saying stuff and writing on stuff that they're not qualified and equipped to write and read on. So, you know, they're like, oh, have you read the new book? This? Of course I've read that book. Well, and then you start asking actual detailed questions about it. Well, it's been a little while. I don't really remember all of it. It's like telltale sign that you actually haven't touched the book or own it even. So, like, there's a big problem of guys who just, like, want to pretend to know everything and are not just transparently honest saying, I haven't read that. I need to. I want to get to it. Like, that's not a bad thing. It's okay to say that. There's a lot of, like, imposter syndrome, and people want to puff up their chest and, like, try to, like, you know, make it sound like they're smarter than they are. You don't need to do that. Just be confident in who you are and say that I haven't read it, and that's okay. But that, if you continue down that path, that causes all sorts of wreckage in your scholarship, whether people realize it or not. The real ones do.
Jordan, so what do you think, this, I think this would be helpful, what do you think are tangible marks of when you know you have mastered some material? When you think you have a really good grasp on a field or an area, what are the tangible marks of what that looks like where you can actually feel confident, yeah, I know what I'm talking about.
Do you have a PhD in it? And do you have other people who, like, did their PhDs in this specialized area? So if you don't have a PhD in it, do you have other PhDs who have specialized in this area saying, yes, you know what you're talking about?
Can you explain it to a child?
Well, yeah, that's fine. have you published in peer review, like legitimate peer reviewed journals on this topic? Because all the faults for peer reviewed journals, whatever they are, there's a lot of them. If you can get something through a double blind peer reviewed academic journal that's well respected on a particular topic, that's usually a good sign that you have a decent grasp on that particular topic. That's usually my, like, measuring stick. Does this person know what they're talking about? Let me go look at their journal publications. Because that's where book publications, that's a total black hole. You have no idea. Because anybody can get a book contract. Will this person sell a book? Well, let's give them a contract. Versus a double-blind peer-reviewed journal where they don't care one bit about, you know, who you are or, you know, how much money you're going to make for the journal, because you're not going to make anything for them. So it's actually supposed to be about the argument itself. And so to me, that's where I look.
Yeah, I think
so
that's
still in the category of don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I don't want to pretend that I know what I'm talking about either, but there is a healthy skepticism of yourself that everybody should have, and it's okay to have that. Like, you know, don't be the obnoxious person who, like, intentionally pretends to, like, you know, like the false humility where you're, like, going around, like, saying, like, you know less than you actually know. Like, that's annoying. But there's the flip side of, you don't want to let pride and ambition, selfish ambition, overtake you.
Yeah, and I think there's an element too of, though, is you want to be aware of conversations even if you haven't, like, done a deep dive into them. Like, so, like, I'm familiar enough with William Lane Craig's views on certain subjects, even though I've never actually studied William Lane Craig, you know, like, and read his books in full. But I know enough about what he's saying that I can know, hey, these are some other options that are out there. This is some of the conversations that are going on So like when someone asked me about, you know, Creation or Historical Adam, like I haven't read his book, but I know a little bit about his view. I read some reviews of it. And so I think it's important to be aware of conversations, even if you're not experts on those conversations. Yeah. And I think that's an important thing to cultivate.
I think that's right. But I wouldn't go around parading myself as an expert on the historical Adam or anything like that, because I'm not.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know all the details about it. I can, you know, you can be have an intelligent conversation, a useful conversation about it. Same thing with like somebody like Bavinck. I mean, I've read enough Bavinck to be dangerous. I've published on him, yeah, but I still am not a Bavinck expert. I haven't read everything he's written. I haven't read him in the original languages. But what I can do is I can go ask, email James Eglinton and say, hey, am I off base here? And if he tells me that I'm in the right track, and if I talk to Gray, Sutanto, and other people, then I'm going to be like, yeah, okay, I'm running with this. Where if they tell me, no, that's wrong, I'm going to quickly say, okay, I'll drop it.
Yeah. I think that might be a good note to end on, and just to kind of summarize some key themes. We're excited about retrieval. We're excited about historical and theological work. I think there just needs to be a kind of scholarly humility to stick to proper methods, stay in your genre, be honest and transparent about exactly what you're claiming and why you're claiming it, and it's just, I think, basic honesty. Honesty with the sources, honesty with your research. And so, anyway, I hope that this conversation has been useful and stimulating to listeners. And we hope that it doesn't stifle any genuine academic interest in retrieval and historical work and theological work as well. We hope that it will be like a refiner's fire to help you purify your methodology so that your work can stand the test of time, to bring it back to a kind of where we began. I think that's one of the things we can admire so much about the works of someone like Timothy George or Michael Haken or Tom Nettles or Jim Renahan or Bevington and others, plenty of others, is that they've done a really good job of being historians. And of course they're theologians as well, but I think they've done a really good job methodologically of writing books and articles and essays that they can stand behind. And that's really what we want to do in our kind of productive work, is to write essays, write articles, write books. And for me and Hunter and others who are in ministry, preach sermons that are going to communicate truth that endures for more than just the trendy moment. And so that's kind of the hope, is that we're really building on a firm foundation. And so Jordan, you can sign us off, and Caleb, if you have something to conclude with as well.
As a preview of good historical theology, later this year, Hunter has a great article on John Owen's interpretation of Scripture coming out in the Hanover Review, where he will be an expert and will know more about John Owen than the Banner of Truth.
That's right.
I wouldn't say that, but I was happy to.
We've got some great journals coming out this year. Very exciting. Yes, so if you're listening to this, you should go purchase a copy of it, or purchase a digital subscription, or whatever it is that you need to do to make sure that you get copies of these, because this is some great stuff. I'm very excited about the quality of the journal and the next level steps that people like Caleb have taken the journal. So we're very excited about it. I'm not trying to be an elitist about my takes, but I'll tell you, you do need to have a PhD in philosophy, theology, and history if you want to do good theology. That's a joke.
You need three PhDs.
That's right. Get the two. No, you got to have three. But I think Garrett did well. And you know, that's my baby monitor telling me the baby's awake again. So this is a perfect time for me to sign off and say thanks everybody for tuning in and listening to the only analytic Baptist confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.